This program is a rather lengthy interview with Robert Shelton, Imperial Wizard of the United Clans of America. The interview was taped at Mr. Shelton's home in Tuscaloosa last Christmas Eve. I made the appointment for the interview simply by calling Mr. Shelton's mother, he has an unlisted phone number, and explaining who I was and that I wanted to tape her son for a radio program. I gave her my phone number, and the Imperial Wizard promptly called me back, and we set a time. My mother was somewhat worried about my going, so I told her she could go with me if she wished, and she did. I was a little nervous, and pretended not to be, and we got lost getting there. The Sheltons live in an isolated, wooded area on a lake, across the river from Tuscaloosa proper. We finally found the house by stopping nearby and asking if anyone knew where Mr. Shelton lived, and the first people we asked knew. The Shelton's house is a small ranch-type brick one, which could very easily fit into any suburban area anywhere. Mr. Shelton came out to greet us and took us into his den, apologizing for the disorganization of the room. He had only been back from prison a few days, and there was the Christmas tree to get and decorate, and he was trying to get out an issue of his Klan publication, The Fiery Cross. While I set up the tape recorder, my mother asked Mr. Shelton about some Sheltons she had taught in first grade, and as to whether they were relatives. Mr. Shelton said they were, and after exchanging information on them, we started the interview, which you will hear as soon as I say about two more things. One is what Carl Ellabash, the editor of Tuscaloosa's weekly newspaper, that he estimated Robert Shelton represented the point of view of 0.5% of the Tuscaloosa white community, and he hoped that I would say so. The second thing is about the interview itself. Having heard it now a few times, I am quite aware of how little I challenge Mr. Shelton, and I have wondered why that was. I have come to the conclusion that the reason for that is, on my part, one part apprehension, one part a sort of growing depression as the interview went on, and a third part that I simply wanted to see if I could get him to say something that I could relate to, you know, as a person, which would probably be something about his family or himself. I don't think I achieved that, because now, as then, I feel very alien to Mr. Shelton, and to myself sitting there listening to him. Since today is the day before Christmas, Christmas Eve day, and since Mr. Shelton has three children, I particularly appreciate you taking this opportunity to talk with me. The program which I am doing is to accumulate as a different variety of views in an attempt to present a picture of a place. And maybe a good place to start would be to talk about your recent experiences with Congress.
Well, first of all, as you know, I was brought before a committee on un-American activities, which I must say, first of all, is a fraudulent way and means and methods that the extreme left or liberal element has of trying to associate someone with a group or an organization or structure that has a bad. You see, the United Clans of America had created quite a stumbling block in the pathway of the present administration and also the Johnson administration. And they realized that in order to remove the stumbling block from the pathway of the bureaucracy, they first of all had to remove the United Clans of America, since it had created quite a problem to the Johnson administration. As you well know, Johnson's name was not even carried on the ballot here in the state of Alabama on his last presidential bid. Therefore, that is a reason that we were called before the so-called Committee on Un-American Activities. The United Clans of America is very definitely not a un-American activity group. It is not an un-American organization. It is the only organization that was organized entirely by Americans for Americans on the shoreline of America. All other fraternal organizations have in the past been organized by foreign entanglements or foreign governments. The United Clans of America is pro. It is not con. We were hauled before this committee for the sole purpose of trying to disillusion the minds of the people, as I said previously. The old communistic tendency is to associate somebody with something that has a bad taste, and their theory is that you've got to smear somebody that they fear, and certainly the communistic element in this country fears the United Clans of America. And I feel that we were unjustly used by the Committee on Un-American Activities. If you'll remember, there have been some 20-some-odd previous Supreme Court decisions that ruled in favor of the Communist Party and in favor of the NAACP, ruling that you cannot force an officer of an incorporation to present his membership for exposure's sake for the purpose of harassment and intimidation. And I might add also that myself and my companions have been the only ones that have ever served prison terms. There have been some 14 people cited for contempt of Congress. And if you remember, so many people talk about the Nixon administration being so conservative in its taste. Well, James Farmer, who was cited for contempt of court and was also cited for contempt of Congress, rather than serving a prison term, the Nixon administration appointed him to a cabinet post in Washington, D.C. And we could see the known communists and the Communist Party itself, even though an act of Congress was passed saying that a member of the Communist Party must register with the Attorney General or suffer a fine of $1,000 a day and imprisonment, but yet not one member of the Communist Party has yet had to register. And not one member on this basis of not registering has served any time in prison. So you can see the law that applies to Robert Shelton and the United Clans of America certainly does not apply to the Communist Party, the NAACP, or the Negro militant organizations that set forth in trying to destroy and to disrupt this country. And I feel that this in itself is an injustice that's aimed directly at the Southerner.
Well, you served how long and where?
Well, I served 9 months and 3 days on a one-year sentence at the Federal Correctional Institution of the Federal Prison in Texarkana, Texas. I received, as you have, under the statute of the Prison and Parole Board system, you're given a 60-day statutory good time. In other words, they give you 60 days good time off of your original sentence to hold over your head as a sledge.
Okay.
That if you comply and abide with the rules and regulations, that you wouldn't get out 60 days earlier. And however, I won special awards and recognition for outstanding work in the capacity of what I was doing in the administration building. And I received an additional 30 days in what they call a Section 2 award for outstanding work.
This is a little bit of an aside, but would there be anything you'd care to say about your experience?
No individual has a basic knowledge of what transpires and what takes place behind the walls of a prison until he has that actual experience. And I can truthfully say that I gain knowledge of what actually happens in a totally and fully integrated government community. And this is all that you can say that the federal prison system is, since they have total and complete integration. The militants, the Negro militants in the prison, runs the prison just as though the militants run our government on the outside. The Black Panthers, the Black Muslims, and the other militant organizations were allowed the opportunity to have their secret meetings twice weekly. On the other hand, if a white man was to mention the word racial integrity or racial purity or white supremacy, he would be thrown in the hole or he would be castigated by the security force of the prison. To me, the prison system as we have it today is a forest. It's no such thing as rehabilitation of the prisoners. A prison of today is nothing more than the breeding ground for further crime. You see the younger people, say the 19 or 20-year-old men come into prison. The first offense, maybe they've been charged with stealing an automobile. Their entire sentence is based upon emotionalism of a federal judge, of how he feels. Suppose he's been out on a deer hunt and he bagged him a 10-point buck, and he hadn't had any arguments with his wife over the weekend, and he doesn't have a heavy head from having too much to drink, and he's feeling good, and he looks cheerful at the whole world. He looks down upon this individual at Monday morning in court, and he says, well, I'll give the kid a break, so therefore we might sentence him to 6 months for a National Motor Vehicle Theft Act. On the other hand, the following week, the judge probably misses his 10-point buck, and he and his wife had a little trouble domestic-wise, and he's had a little bit too much to drink, and he's got a headache on Monday morning. He looks down at the same compatible case, and suddenly to this individual, he melts out 6 years. Well, the two individuals come in contact with each other in prison, the one with a 6-month sentence and the one with the 6 years. Maybe the one with the 6 months has been a 3-time loser. Maybe he's been in the penitentiary 3 times previously, or he could have been involved in a 3, 4, 5, or 6 state car-wide car theft ring. And yet he only gets 6 months or a year. Then this young kid comes in, he gets 4 years, 5 years, or 6 years for virtually the same crime as being his first offense. I'd say the first 6 months he's scared, he's frightful. Then after a period of 6 or 8 months, he becomes resentful. And it's understandable why. He soon adopts the attitude, well, if this is the way justice is melted out, I might as well take advantage of being in here and learn from the professionals. So therefore, he starts acquainting himself with the ways and means of tripping the tumblers in a lock, or how to break into a safe, or how to crosswire an automobile, or how to file the numbers or stamp the numbers, things of this nature. And two, you have a lot of sex perversion in prison, which is a dastardly thing for the young people. Out of the population that we had in the Federal Correctional Institution of 550 men, I would say, conservatively speaking, known sex deviants, there were approximately 20% of the total population. And this is something to contend with. The young ones coming in, they're frightfully away from home for the first time. It's the first offense. And I would have to say that I would be directing mind. It's not charges, it's an accusation, and you might say a charge also, because I'm not talking about things that I've heard about. I'm talking about things that I've seen that I know exist. I would have to say that it would have to be directed at the entire penal system in this country. They go at it right backwards. If they're going to have rehabilitation, they first of all got to rehabilitate the federal judges. I'm talking now on a federal level, because this is where my experience has been. I was sentenced myself emotionally. The judge that sentenced me was a Catholic. He was in Washington, D.C. as a federal judge. The jury that tried me was composed of federal employees. Out of the 12 on the jury, 9 were Negro. And it's easy to see why I was convicted, because I was being discriminated, and there was prejudice, and there was no way in the world for a fair trial, because the people had no basic knowledge of the technicalities involved.
Well, how did you come out of prison? Did you experience any of these feelings that you felt? Any of these feelings you were just mentioning, bitterness or...
Well, I would have to say I'm not the same person now that I was before I went to prison. Yes, I have a little bitterness. And I'm sure that most of the people that are in prison has bitterness when they can view on television and see the black militancy as they run wild through this country, burning buildings to the ground, totally destroying our society, the Black Panther element, collecting money from our federal bureaucracy through their subsidizing program to the Office of Economic Opportunity, the poverty program, which they in turn are buying guns and ammunition and storing them up and openly advocating killing policemen. When men in prison are sent there for violating a law technically, as they call it, income tax evasion, or failing to pay income tax, or some technicality in securities and things of this nature, and when they are given outrageous sentences of 10, 15, 16 years for a little technicality, and they can sit back and see on the news where the Negroes openly are observed and watched by the police forces of this nation as they burn buildings, they break glass windows, they loot, rob, steal, and the prison's television cameras and everything else, and yet nothing is done about it. This code is an individual to have resentment in prison, and rightfully so. I resent it myself. I resent the fact that the law only applies to Robert Shelton. It doesn't apply to the Communist Party or the Negro Militants or the others that are site of contempt to Congress. When I went to Washington, I went there, as I have been taught all my life by my father and the upbringing, to be respectful and to recognize these individuals and show respect to them, which I did. I only invoked my constitutional privileges. At the same time, I saw so-called pseudo-intellectuals from Chicago and other places that were investigated by the same committee, as they walked forth and actually spat in the face of the congressman on this committee. Yet not one of those people have served any time in prison with contempt of Congress. I saw these students that traveled to Cuba when their visa had been canceled. I saw these individuals create such a turmoil and demonstrations in the committee hearing rooms that they couldn't even conduct the affairs, and they called them pigs and spit in their face and everything else. Not one of these persons have served any time in prison for contempt of Congress.
A tape difficulty here obscured a bit of conversation, during which I asked Mr. Shelton if he would turn his thoughts to Tuscaloosa.
I don't think much has happened in Tuscaloosa in the last 5 years. You see, the only time anything happened in Tuscaloosa is when some of the biased individuals in New York, Pennsylvania, Chicago wants to ease their own guilt complex and point a finger at Tuscaloosa. It's so easy for them to relieve their own guilt complex by saying what you do in Tuscaloosa or how bad you treat the poor oppressed race of people. When there are more people killed violently by acts of violent crimes in New York City in one day than it is in a year in Tuscaloosa. When there are more rapes in Washington, D.C., where the women are pulled out of the doorways of their congressional offices and the Senate office buildings and the Justice Department buildings and raped within view of the Capitol, more in one day than it ever is in a year's time in Tuscaloosa. It's so much easier for this conspiracy and the elements of this conspiracy to always castigate the Southern people, mm-hmm. because they have the advantage. They have the control of the news media. The television, the radio, and the newspapers today, to an extent, is on a control basis. Now, that's one thing I'll have to agree with Sparrow Agnew. To a certain element, it is controlled. Because one man like Samuel Neuhauser, who is a Russian Jew, cannot come to this country in a period of 26 years, build up an amassed fortune and wealth of some 600 radio and television stations and networks without having some help from an invisible government.
May I just have an aside that would, I think, be of interest about your qualification of your agreement with Vice President Agnew? Are you not an Agnew admirer, or do you?
No, I'm. My warning is to beware of Greeks with free gifts. I think Spiro Agnew is doing a service for Nixon, which I am not in accord with Nixon. I'm just working up a little article for our Firecross magazine that we publish and going over some of the things that I was going to write in one of the articles and about the left-wing element that Nixon has in his cabinet. And the more I examine his cabinet members and run research on, the more I find that he is more liberal than even Kennedy and Johnson was as far as his appointments. And I think that Spiro Agnew actually is the Greek that's bearing the gifts for the purpose of the fear in the 1972 presidential election that he's got to come down to Wallace country give a Wallace-type speech in order to try to knock off the effectiveness that Wallace might have in 1972. While he's talking out of one side of his mouth, here in Wallace country, we are seeing that Nixon is very cleverly enforcing more and more school desegregation all over the country. The Nixon administration, in my opinion, has desegregated more schools and school boards in Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana, and Georgia alone, the entire system of the Kennedys and the Johnson in their tenure of office.
WBAI New York.
What do you feel about the current administration here in Tuscaloosa?
I'm glad to see a change. I think that there's been too much leniency involved here in Tuscaloosa.
Oh, in what way?
With the merchants. I'm the type of person, I believe in a strong free enterprise system. And when you allow a group of militants or anyone to control the free enterprise system as they're doing here. Now, all of your people downtown will constantly tell the white people, now, you can't boycott. When you boycott, it's a violation of federal law. And I don't see any lawyers, I don't see any FBI agents harassing, or I don't see any marshals harassing the Negroes that are picketing some of the stores downtown now and boycotting the stores.
You're thinking perhaps of the Piggly Wiggly?
The Piggly Wiggly stores, yes. I'm just glad I'm not in business, because the first time what I'm put up a picket line in front of my place is where I'd leave them laying, regardless of what the federal government. I think it's time that this so-called silent majority shakes the bushes and makes just a little bit of noise.
Mm-hmm.
We've been silent too long. I'm not advocating violence. I don't believe in violence. But when somebody gets on my toe, I'm going to get them off.
Uh-huh.
I'm certainly concerned with some of the downtown business people that are going around buying up tracts of land and selling to the black Muslims, to the Islamic cult. To me, this is nothing more than them having the base of operations, because they've got to have an area for guerrilla warfare training, which they're noted for doing. They've also got to have a base of operations of storage of the guns and the ammunition. And to many people, this kind of talk is radical.
Well, do you think there is...
Hard standing, but it's truthful. This has already happened. You've seen some of it on television.
Do you think, though, that Alabama would be the best climate for this to work in?
Yes, ma'am. Alabama is the only area one of the only areas that it can work in. There are basically 8 southern states that this entire revolution has involved itself in. If you'll stop and read your 1964 Civil Rights Bill and Voter Registration Bill, it doesn't apply to New York, Cincinnati, Ohio, or Chicago, Illinois. The Voter Registration Law only applies to about 11 southern states. What applies to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, doesn't apply to Yonkers, New York, or White Plains, New York.
Mm-hmm.
It's only in this area. Why? Because it dates back to the early 20s when the communists realized that if they were going to overthrow and overtake this government, that they had to concentrate on the area of its greatest strength. And we, of the 8 southern states, which is known as the Black Belt of this nation, gave them the weapon. Because the minority element was in this section of the country, the mass of them. And at the same time, it being the Black Republic, as they call it, they wanted to organize what they call the Socialistic Black Republic of America. And they wanted to put the Negro Communist Paul Robinson as a commissar. And their sole reason for that is simply because this area of the 8 southern states is also known and referred to as the Bible Belt of this nation. And in order to overthrow this government, they've got to destroy the backbone of the nation.
Mm-hmm.
This part of the country is the backbone because it's the Bible Belt.
Mm-hmm.
What better way to destroy the faith of the people than to create the division and animosity of the Christian people, whether they're white or black?
Mm-hmm.
Create a gap, division, animosity, ill will. Keep those two factions of people fighting one another, where the true conspirators, the Antichrist, slips in through infiltration unnoticed until they gain hold and control.
Mm-hmm. And have you seen evidence of that here in Tuscaloosa?
Oh, absolutely. You got this T.Y. Rogers, the so-called Negro preacher.
What about Mr. Malachin?
Well, he's just another... Malachin, to me, is another Martin Luther King. They're not concerned about helping the Negro race of people. They're concerned with themselves. T.Y. Rogers is not concerned with helping the Negro race of people. He's concerned with helping himself.
A lot of people, or a lot of Southern people, that feel that people in the North criticize the Southern police unjustly, the Southern policemen. I wondered what your feeling about that was, particularly your feeling about the Tuscaloosa Police Department. And I don't want you to feel you're being put on the spot.
I don't mind talking about Tuscaloosa Police Department. I think they've done a tremendous job. I don't say so in some of the leadership capacity. When they had the first problems here, when the T.Y. Rogers' church and group was demonstrating and using the churches to throw out the bottles and throw out all the mustard and things upon the police officers, and they had to break it up. I think they did the right thing when they cracked a few heads, when they resisted and everything else. The only way that you can cope with a problem of this nature, I don't care whether it's black or white, is to use brute force. And when they realize that force is going to be used to maintain law and order, you don't have the disruption, you don't have the problem. This appeasement that goes on in New York and Chicago and everywhere else, you see what it's brought. You get a higher rate of crime, increase in crime, you've got murders, assault, rape, disrespect for law, and it causes people themselves to have disrespect and disconcern with what's even happening in their midst. When a young girl can be assaulted in the presence of 15 or 25 people, they make no effort to go to her rescue. This is what it breeds. This is the atmosphere it brings about. And I think the police departments, if the courts would leave their hands free to act, and if it means meeting brute force with brute force, do that. And therefore, you eliminate this future events of trouble that you're going to have.
What about the Arthurine Lucy situation?
Well, I think the Arthurine Lucy situation, everybody well knew what was in advance in the beginning of that. There was a hired agent provocateur that was brought in by the element. I think one, her registering mate, Polly Hudson Stroh. What was her name? I forgot it now. Anyhow, she was, I think, pregnant at the same time she was trying to enter the university, and that was the reason she was rejected and turned down. They had no intention of education. They were just the scapegoats to be
mm-hmm.
used.
I was wondering, though, because we're talking about the police, about your feeling about the police in that situation. The Tuscaloosa police.
Well, I think the Tuscaloosa police department, the men themselves, have done a tremendous job. As I said, I kind of disagree with some of the leaders of the
mm-hmm. well, as you know,
because I think they're political opportunists. Some of them that has got the praise from Robert Kennedy and has mm-hmm. talked to Robert Kennedy. They're more concerned about a created image mm-hmm. than they are in carrying out the duties and responsibility.
What about your feeling about the fact that in the last 5 years all the schools have been integrated? This morning I was talking with Mr. Chancy, who, you know, said things were fully integrated in his opinion. What do you think about that? Do you think it is full integration? If so, what feeling do you have about it? And thirdly, what effect do you think that will have?
Well, first of all, we've got to create a reverse in the cycle of what has been integrated is going to have to be changed. It can't exist. I think Washington, D.C. is a prime example. This was to be the model city in the school system when the Supreme Court made its infamous decision in 1954 on the Black Monday ruling. They said, we'll take the school system in Washington and make an example. This will be the model school system to meet and comply with the Supreme Court's decision. So according to the governmental committee reports now, since it's gone past the 12-year period of time,
mm-hmm.
we find that the students that are graduating from the 12th grade today in Washington, D.C. are on an equal IQ with that of the 10th grade student of 1955. So that means that this model city, this typical situation of complete and total desegregation, the sample that was to be given out to the rest of the world, shows that it caused the students to lose 2 years of advancement. In other words, for the graduating class today in the 12th grade, it was on an equal with the 10th grade class in 1955 in Washington.
Do you feel that?
This is the entire procedures of the desegregation. That's the purpose of it. They're talking about equality, and we've got to help the poor oppressed race of people. You can't help a wild animal of putting it in the pen with a pet. You first got to cultivate it. Now the white people and the people in this country have lived in a cultured civilization for over a span of 3,000 years. And a lot of people haven't stopped and realized that the Negro was walking on diamonds in Africa, even though they glittered in the sunlight. He walked over those for numbers of years without realizing the value. And even though Africa, the continent of Africa, is surrounded by water on all sides, he never dreamed of sail, he never dreamed of boat to explore beyond his own bounds. Now, he didn't even build him a house, even though there was stone and lumber. The only house he built was out of sticks and mud. And he was not cultivated until the white man went in and cultivated these resources. And our forefathers have built the great cities that we have today. They had the insanity, they had the ingenuity. They carved these cities out of the mass jungles, and the neighbor race of people had the same opportunity in Africa. But they didn't advance it. They didn't have the ability, the knowledge, or the incentive to do it until the white man went over and showed them how. And a lot of Negroes today castigate the Southerners about slavery. That's the greatest thing that ever happened to the Negro race of people, was slavery. For it had not been for slavery that brought them from their flesh-eating tribes in Africa and brought them to this country and put them into a culture, civilization, brought them out of the dense jungles of Africa, they wouldn't be on the ladder of success that they are today. It was a white man that developed them and brought them along. But you cannot put a race of people that's only been out of the dense jungles of Africa for a span of 300 years and throw them immediately into a cultured civilization that's existed for over 3,000 years.
But do your children go to
a... They certainly do not.
They go to a private school?
They go to a Christian school, Western Baptist Christian school.
Oh, but
to me, this is the unfair injustice that's being applied by government today, because the children are the ones that are being caused to suffer. You can't, as I said before, you can't raise the Negro race of people up on an equal with the white. Whether it's in schooling, whether it's in housing, in the community, or in society, or what it is. You can only do one thing, as the situation has proven itself in Washington, D.C. school system. You can only bring the white race down. And by continually bringing the white race down, you bring them down to a level with the Negro race of people. You don't bring the Negro up to the level of the white.
Mm-hmm.
You're bringing the white and driving the white down onto a level of that of the Negro. And that's the entire program of desegregation that's transpiring and taking place. When you have blockbusting in a community, and a Negro family moves in, you don't raise the prestige of that Negro. You devalue the property of the white. You bring it down and put it on the level. When you bring about amalgamation and interracial marriage, you don't elevate the Negro, you lower the white. The entire program is bringing the white race down. This so-called jazz music, the rock band of nudity and so forth is going on now. It's not a constructive music. It's nothing that motivates spirit and a Christian feeling. It's a rum-tum-tum version of jungle music that brings out sex impulse, and that's all. And what is this doing to our youth today? You're seeing the hippie land type. You're seeing the drug abuse. You're seeing the demoralization of youth minds and immorality. What's it doing? It's lowering our society. It's driving it into the ground. You're not elevating it.
What solution would you see?
Complete and total, not segregation, but separation.
You mean a different land?
Well, we know that's practically impossible. That would be the only answer or solution that I could see.
Are you in agreement with the Muslims, the black Muslims, on that point? I mean, do they not advocate a separate land, if possible?
Well, they advocate or demanding that we turn over to them so many states in this country.
Hmm.
I say this is a white man's land. It was cultivated with a white man, and if they want an area of separation, then go back to the homeland culture of Africa. But we have got to have separation in schools. You've got to have you don't have equality in the schools throughout the country today because of the government ruling, the Supreme Court ruling.
What do you have?
You have discrimination in the school system, because if there was such a thing as having equality in the school system, an equal opportunity of choice, you would have to have a free school system. You'd have to have an integrated system. You'd have to have an all-black and an all-white. If everyone the choice of which school they wanted to go to, then you would have equality. But as it is today, you don't have equality. You have forced.
Do you think this what you call forced integration has changed the minds, you might say the minds and the hearts of the white people who are involved in it?
Well, if I'm kind of, in a sense, appreciative of the fact my tenure of rest, so to speak, of 9 months in the federal institution, because it gave me a complete knowledge of what total desegregation in a government community would be. I only had ideas of what it was beforehand, but now I have the actual experience of total desegregation, and I know what it is. And it's frightening, because you cannot take the white race of people and blend them in with the society, the culture that is the Negro race, because the two races are entirely different.
Well, do you think it's really realistic? I mean, do you think there's any, that there's a really realistic chance of changing the present, I would say the present actions of the Justice Department, or the present rulings of the Supreme Court? I think there's a realistic chance of changing that, much less going back and again segregating schools.
I think so. I think you're going to see complete segregation. You're going to see the entire problem reverse itself, because such as in Prohibition days, they thought it wouldn't work. And I think that we're more and more every day realizing that desegregation in the school system and communities and life is not going to work. So in very rare occasions, you might have some liberal individual, like some professor at the university that's down here as a transplant for a purpose of provoking and bringing about the problem, would send his child to an all-black school. I think that in a period of time, we're going to see complete separation. It's going to revert itself back in another cycle, as the old Prohibition days.
Mm-hmm.
Because...
But would that be conceivable?
We're going to have racial integrity. We're going to have decency and morality and advancement. We've got to have complete separation. We cannot have an integrated society.
Yeah, but my only point is I don't want to question you further on that, because I think you've stated your reasons for it. But do you really think that's practical? I mean,
I do.
Practical in the sense of
Absolutely.
Being realistic.
Because when I look in the face of my child, it's practical to want to preserve that child.
I don't mean practical in that sense. I mean practical in the sense of having any realistic...
I think it's going to help my role with the country, because if it doesn't, we're going to have an open and violent, bloody revolution. There's no way around it. The people, not only in the South, but as I find in traveling all up north, I just come back off of a tour up on the eastern seaboard up mm-hmm. into Connecticut, Maryland, Washington, that area there. The white people themselves, all over the country, are beginning to realize it is now a fight of self-preservation.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're going to survive as a Christian nation, that we're going to have to fight for it. And
mm-hmm.
they're at the point now that if it takes a revolution, they're ready to get ready for that revolution.
Well, do you think that situation exists here in Tuscaloosa?
It's more so here than most people realize. You've got treacherous individuals that are involved with this conspiracy, particularly the University of Alabama crowd. You've got dope. You've got marijuana. I tried to tell people here some 4 years ago about the excessive amount of marijuana and dope, the traffic that was involved at this university. And they laughed at me. They said it was impossible, but now they realize it is so. But this is nothing new. This marijuana and the LSD and things of this nature have been going on. You've got professors at the University of Alabama that are advocating this and are actually involved. This is something that's very distasteful to me, that people will cover up the activities of certain individuals because they're involved and they're worried about the reputation of their town or their college. There are people at the University of Alabama on the staff and on the payroll of the state that are just as guilty and involved in the dope and the traffic in this college, in this town, as any of the biggest dope addicts and pushers that you'll find on the street corner. Before Dr. Rose got himself so involved in trying to grab out of the federal money, he couldn't build up something here that is going to bankrupt the entire state to try to keep just what he drug in through the federal monies. You started attracting that type because you had to lessen the restrictions that you had. on the entrance of individual. Now you're getting some of the trash of the country that's coming into this college to where you had a different clientele 5 years or 10 years ago. But now we're seeing the bearded beatniks, you're seeing these peaceniks, these peace creepers, whatever you want to call them. I don't necessarily say that I support the war in Vietnam. I say I support the American troops that are in Vietnam. And if we have a commitment that's been made in Vietnam, I say let's live up to that commitment and get the war over with. Because it's certainly unfair to fight communism 10,000 miles away from home and allow it to go unchecked on the shorelines here in the United States. And I think that if the money changers and the Zionist Jews that are involved as the financial wizards of this country, the Rothschilds all the way into Europe, the Warburgs, the Kuhns and the Loebs, all of the financial supporters of communism themselves, if we would go ahead and end the war, which could be done if they would allow the generals to run the war in Vietnam, it would be over in a period of 3 to 4 months if they'd keep the politics out and let the generals fight their battles. Then we could bring our troops back home.
Well, is there much opposition to the war here in Tuscaloosa, to your knowledge?
The only opposition that I've encountered is some of these peaceniks that are coming in from other places to the University of Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, a lot of people, as we've always in World War I, World War II, and even the Civil War, we don't like to see American boys' lives being lost, but we realize that if we don't fight communism and if we don't live up to the commitments, then in the future of 5-10 years, when our younger generation comes up, they'll be having to face the same issue again.
Do you think there are many people that you would call hippies here at Tuscaloosa?
Well,
here
it's
in Tuscaloosa?
Increasing daily. The cult, as you want to call them, that is increasing. Mainly from the university.
Mm-hmm.
And any time that you have a college town like Tuscaloosa, the university governs in a certain degree.
Tell me, you know, I'm curious because I've never read anything about your own background. Did you live here in Tuscaloosa? Did you grow up?
I was born and raised here in Tuscaloosa. Lived here all my life. In fact, my father lived over on 15th Street.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I spent all my life until I went to service.
And when was that?
That was in 1946, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I went in the Air Force and the airlift in Germany for 3.5 years. And then I returned back. And
what drew you back here after the service?
Well, I was working local industry here, and I returned to my job. And
were you married then?
No, I wasn't married. Married after I returned from.
Is your wife a local Tuscaloosa girl?
Here in Tuscaloosa also. So you see, my.
Well, what kept you here after you got back?
Well, I like Tuscaloosa. So I think it's one of the cleanest little towns that you'll find anywhere. The people, you have the southern hospitality here that you don't find in a lot of other places. And of course, my parents are here.
Mm-hmm.
And I just like the town. I just like the people here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's.
Are you satisfied with it as a place for your children to grow up?
Well, I'm satisfied with the community. I'm certainly not satisfied with the university. I think that the university has made drastic changes, and I'm sorry to say for the worst. But there is a lot of encouragement with Dr. Matthews, I believe, the new president.
My sister-in-law works at that, and she says that about him, too. She knows him.
That I think that you're going to see some changes for the betterment.
Mm-hmm. Would you?
See, this is something that I'm fearful of. Most people don't realize it's well and good that you can say, well, there's so much federal money there, if you don't get it, somebody else will. But you've got to stop and realize we, you and I, have got to put that federal money there through taxation before it's there available for anybody. And the more you grab, the more you've got to put. And as the trend of government is today, the more that you accept federal money, the more strings that are attached, and you lose individual liberties and freedoms on a local government basis. And your college today is so entwined in federal bureaucracy through the grants of federal money. that they have no, you have no true academic freedom. Well, as a college, because it's governed by the federal bureaucracy, you do this or else. Uh-huh. You're seeing demoralization take place. You're seeing, 10 years ago, who'd ever thought it was going to be all right for girls and boys to live in the same dormitory, to share a room side by side? I mean, this is something that's going far and beyond.
Well, ma'am, were you ever associated with the university? Did you think of going there to
school?
Well,
I went to the university for a period of time before I went to service. And when I returned, I took up a vocational trade at the Shelton Vocational Trade School. More or less kind of a hobby, mechanics.
What field were you interested in when you were at the university?
I was interested in history and pre-law.
History and pre-law.
I was in law school, pre-law. But I don't know. I wouldn't take anything from my experience. I think that the actual experience of travel.
You've been quite a few places.
Just about in every state in the Union. I guess there's not too many southern towns and cities that I haven't been in.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, this is an education. I wouldn't trade my experiences of meeting people and having daily contact with people. Or have a PhD or MA degree that you can get from a college.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's actual contact and being with people and sharing their victories and sharing their losses and getting to know the average man, his family, what his problem is, and him discussing it. This is an education.
A minister said if you got to know a black person and his family and his problems, that would, in the way you're speaking, change your views of the whole, what you'd call, I guess, the racial situation. Would you agree or would you have any thoughts
on that? I would disagree, because as I said before, I just don't believe that the culture of the white and black race is going to put families on an equal basis now.
Mm-hmm.
There are Negroes that I respect, a lot of them that I respect. I have more respect for some Negroes than I do a lot of white people. And I am not against totally the Negro race of people. I think the Negro has got to earn his place in society. You don't solve the problems of society by demanding a minimum income. A lot of people are saying today that to solve this problem, we'll just bring about a $3,600 annual income, guarantee everybody $3,600 whether they work or not. Well, this is ridiculous.
We wouldn't care whether we work or not.
All right, suppose you go ahead and give everybody that's not making $3,600, $3,600. The wheel just simply turns over. They're still the same poverty group. So next year, they're still the poverty group. If you give them $5,000. See, this verifies my suspicions and the whole thing of the so-called civil rights movement. You see, Abernathy, and even King, before he was assassinated, had gotten off of going into motels and restaurants and schools. He was talking on the basis of poverty. Well, there's been poverty ever since biblical times. There's always going to be poverty. But when a president of the United States like Lyndon Johnson can stand up on television and take the cue from Martin Luther King and say that in order to cope with the ills of society, that we might have to take from the haves and give to the have-nots. Well, this, in its truest form, is socialism, which you've got to have before you advance to communism.
Yeah.
But if you take from the haves and give to the have-nots, you're going to destroy the incentive of the haves to be productive, provide jobs, employment for the have-nots. So soon your haves are going to take the attitude, well, if they're going to give what I make and take away from me and give to the have-nots, why should I have the incentive, the fortitude to forge forward and be productive?
How did you become involved with the Klan? Were you always interested?
Well, I've always been interested, as I said, in political science and history.
Mm-hmm.
As you notice there, I have quite a... that's just a few of my old books that date back to 1800,
I
50,
see,
1860, the history that you don't find in schools nowadays that have been destroyed from the bookshelf.
Well, that must be interesting. She majored in political science.
I have some books that I collect old books of history that date back into the 1800s. Mm-hmm. Those on the bottom shelf over there go on to vivid and deep details of the war between the states. I think the last copy.
That's the standard history of the world?
Well, the other one, I believe, on the other end, it gives you a deep detail of your...
Library of American History, right. By Ellis, it looks like.
Last printing on that book was in 1900. The first printing was in 1870.
It's volumes 1 through 8.
Right, and...
It's history that you don't find now in schools. And it's amazing to read the history of this time.
Mm-hmm.
Books and then pick up a history book of today and see the variation, the difference.
Mm-hmm.
The contents completely change.
Well, you were saying how you got involved in the Klan, how you got interested in the Klan. You said you'd always been interested in history.
Well,
and political science.
Also politics. So.
Well, were you always of the same viewpoint, or has your viewpoint changed as you?
Well, it's changed slightly. As I said before, where I've always been a segregationist, I'm now a separationist. I believe in separation.
Mm-hmm. But when you were a young man in the army and so forth, did you plan to come back and have the career or the kind of life you have ended up having, or did you?
Well, it's a particular time. I didn't have any knowledge as exactly what I was going to do. Of course, my father. Myself and my mother were always in the grocery business. I was born and raised in a meeting department in a grocery store.
I traded with you, right?
Yes, ma'am. And I had thought at one time of continuing in that line of business. And then I also had a job with a local industry. And then I left, transferred from that into... the sales division of that company and stayed with that until economic pressure was brought about for me to resign from that capacity. Mm-hmm. But I never had any actual thought of what I was going to be actively involved in or what I was going to do.
I've got two questions that I want to ask real bad.
Well, ask them.
I know that you can't, just like my husband, who in police work couldn't make every man do as he wanted him to do. But do you get very many who get so emotionally involved in the Ku Klux Klan that you have some trouble?
Yes, that's true occasionally. I don't profess that the United Klan is a perfected organization.
Well, it can become emotionally.
It can be the wrong type people in the realm of control of the organization can pry upon the emotionalism and instability of an individual, and certainly you can lead them off in the wrong directions. I think that the United Klan has done more than any other organization to harness, so to speak, the extra energies of the emotionally concerned person. I truly believe if it hadn't been for this organization that Governor Wallace would not have been able to make the stand that he did at the university. I don't think that many things would have been able to dramatize and to show to the rest of the world the plight and situation of the Southerner had it not been for this organization, because we've been able to harness a lot of the outburst of emotionalism. And kind of keep a rein. It has to go somewhere. I think this organization has done more. And of course, it's overlooked for people. They only see one thing, the bad. They don't see the good. But this organization actually has done more good in harnessing violence than any other organization, bar none.
Well, things that were not in keeping with the Klan's policies being done, but they gave you credit for it.
We've been able to kind of cope with it a little better than we was previously. That's true. There have been many instances that very easily a neighbor could get in an argument with another neighbor. And the age-old maxim is that a burning cross in somebody's yard.
Yeah.
Well, it's if two neighbors have a disagreement, it's very easy for the other one to rig some contraption up like a cross and set it on fire and run back to the telephone, call them up and say, if you don't do so-and-so, we're going to get you or something like that. Now, we've encountered a tremendous amount of this in the past, but as I said, it's kind of narrowing down to where we have too much of this. Because I think that can be attributed to people learning more about the Klan. You see, there's a distinction and a difference. This is the United Klan of America. And they like to use the word Ku Klux Klan because they can always say it's subversive and it's on the Attorney General's list and so forth, but it's not. The United Klan of America is not on the Executive Memorandum Order 10450 with the Attorney General. We've never been cited as a subversive organization. And I might add, out of all of the questions, of the Committee of Un-American Activities and of 300 and something witnesses of our organization they subpoenaed to Washington, they did not ask the first person if he was a member of the Communist Party, if he advocated overthrow of the government, or was affiliated or involved with any subversive activities. It was all the type of question of when you could beat your wife last. Regardless of what answer you give, it would indicate that you might have possibly beat your wife at one time or another. So therefore you had no choice. I've told them many times outside of the committee room that I would answer any questions out in the hallway or out in a cornfield if they want to go to a cornfield on television. I offered to debate any one of the congressmen individually or collectively.
I remember you said that.
But they wouldn't because, see, they're in a position that they can say, well, Mr. Sheldon, isn't it a fact that you paid $5,000 to so-and-so to bump off so-and-so? Well, under oath, which you are, you can say, I certainly did not. They say, well, we have evidence to show otherwise, and just leave it. Well, it's a matter of record. It's in the record. And they left it on that basis. You cannot force them to produce any evidence or even show any of this activity. But yet, on the other hand, with the news media there, and it being a matter of record with the government, the archives, well, then it's open to the controlled press, if they want to be that way, to use that and impress, or leave the impression that you did pay.
Well, one theory I heard was somewhere was that the House was investigating the Klan in order to get enough respectability with the American peoples to investigate the student militant groups. Would you think they would
was the excuse that was offered and used by the Southern politician like Mr. Buchanan, the so-called Baptist preacher from Birmingham who was on this committee, and congressman. This was their excuse in explaining to the people of their constituents as to why they were investigating the Klan, was that we want to go ahead and investigate the Klan so that when we start on Martin Luther King, and when we start on the NAACP, and when we start on the others, that they can't say that we're biased or that we're prejudiced and we're purposely gunning. But this was, there was no intention of investigating Martin Luther King. If J. Edgar Hoover, and if the government would allow the record of Martin Luther King to be released to the general public, the people that have supported him would immediately rip down the name King on every street corner that's named a street after him, anything else. He was the most vile individual.
His
affiliation, his association.
With Highlander, maybe?
Well, Highlander folks, it was nothing more than agents of a foreign government that they have pictures and records of him passing money back and forth from one hand to the other to Kennedy Airport and other places.
They proved that, didn't they?
Yes, they have all this information. But you see, he's the martyr they needed in an election year, and he's the martyr they need to control this element of people to bring about this conspiracy.
Did you ever? Were you in any way? Did you have any knowledge of? Didn't the Senate investigate Highlander?
My knowledge of Highlander Folk School is in Monteagle, Tennessee, which is now in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Uh-huh.
There has never been investigated other than activities being investigated by the Georgia Commission on Education, which was a committee within the state of Georgia, and other small investigating groups.
Mm-hmm.
But
There's something I don't understand. When individuals like Miles Horton and his wife Sophia, who head up and are the directors along with Reverend Minish, and James Dombrowski, and other, Colin Ann Braden, identified and known communists. If these individuals are free to roam all over the country and incite people into the stages of riot, insurrection, well, they contend that they're involved with labor, but it's nothing in the world but indoctrination school, brainwashing, strategy planning. They involve themselves in every involvement of the so-called civil rights, such as Montgomery, Alabama, the Selma March.
Well, I didn't mean to get you on that aside.
Well, Abernathy, who is heading the Southern Christian Leadership now, along with T.Y. Rogers and Coretta King, I'll just put the record to bear out in Montgomery. He was kind of involved in the domestic cases of the young girls
young
and their nature. You'd be surprised at the known sex devious that's involved in the so-called civil rights movement. For example, Langston Hughes, a known communist. He was an advocate that wrote the poem Goodbye Christ, Make Way for a New Man, a man called Marx, Lenin, Trotsky, Step on the Gas, Lord, Move Out of the Way. And Bayard Rustin, who is admitted a sex pervert, who has been very active in the civil rights movement.
Oh, Mr. Shelton, may I smoke? Would
yes,
that bother you? Would you care for a cigarette?
I don't smoke.
That's excellent. Now,
Marsha,
there's
somebody that has the courage you need.
What I found out on this last trip up in Virginia is going to be quite shocking to the people shortly. One of your leading tobacco companies already today is packaging marijuana. 10 sticks to a box. It's being stored in the warehouse now. And the name, one of the names is going to be called Turn-On. Now, this is an indication to me that the lobbyist has assured the companies that they have bought legislation to modify the drug law.
What is your feeling about marijuana specifically?
But marijuana certainly affects the depth precision of an individual. If you're going to have people smoking 2 or 3 sticks of marijuana, get an automobile driving, it's going to be like whiskey. And certainly there's a difference in putting marijuana out on the market and your whiskey and things of this nature. That's the first steps, in my opinion, because you've got to have a starting point. You got to take that first step. And I've seen too much in prison. I know how, even behind the walls, you had narcotics. And once a person gets hooked on this drug addiction, it's very easy to go to the extremes of taking all these Benny pills, grind them up in the powder. I even saw them take aspirins and grind up and mix them with Prince Albert and roll it up and smoke it.
What in your opinion, is the reason for the Klan's image? What in your mind is the reason for this image? Maybe you disagree with me. Maybe I'm misrepresenting.
Well, no, there is an amount of image delusion. But I think basically you would have to say that it's involved itself with sensationalism.
Improved.
Oh, I think it's improved tremendously because the people today in the country are beginning to read between the lines of editorials and newspapers and articles. However, in order to sell a newspaper, you've got to have something sensational for the reader to want to read the paper, want to buy the paper. And the Klan has always been a whipping boy as a selling point, particularly in the South. It's very easy to reach back in the past pedestals of history and take a present situation and put it on a parallel with the Civil War days and through sensationalism, dramatize an incident. And when they refer to the Klan even today in articles, they'll go back and say, in 1938, X number of people lynched, X number murdered, having no knowledge of whether the Klan was ever involved or had any connection to anything else, but it's sensationalism. It's a good copy. It sells.
Well, you know, many of the black people, I think, say the same thing about
news about their organizations?
Well, of course, I realize...
Would you say it was just a trend towards presenting things in a more...
To me, radio is one of the most truthful ways to get the point over to the people. Because on the radio, you just sit down, as we are now, as Roosevelt called them, the fireside chats. You don't have to be a movie star. You don't have to be a dynamic person of expressing with motion of his body and things of this nature. Well, on television, it's got to be dramatic to be newsworthy. And I think people like Walter Cronkite and David Branson, they have to depend on so many people when they give a worldwide report that they actually don't know a lot of the material that's furnished them as to what it is, its authenticity. And they have to depend on staffs. And we've encountered in many cases where some of your staff members are individuals that are prejudiced in the very beginning, and they have aligned themselves with the militants or with the peaceniks. Are the individuals that are outright flaunting the Constitution form of government.
Thus ends the interview with Robert Shelton, Imperial Wizard of the United Clans of America. In the next program, you will have an opportunity to hear some of those representative, as the newspaper editor said, of the other 99.5% of Tuscaloosa's white community. This is Marcia Tompkins. Thank you.